This is Michael Reed Trice with Religica, and in cooperation with the United Nations Environmental Program Faith for Earth Initiative and the Center for Religious Wisdom and World Affairs at STM, Seattle University. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Daniel Wiener, who serves as Vice President of Global Affairs at the University of Connecticut. This is a podcast about a deeper reconnection with ourselves, our communities, and nature. We talk about the Great Reset and seeing hate for what it is. Take a listen.
Hi, I'm Dan Wiener. I am the Vice President Global Affairs at University of Connecticut, and I'm also a professor of geography. This is the end of my eighth year at University of Connecticut. I've also worked at University of Toledo, and I've worked at West Virginia University, and I've worked at Ohio University. And this is my 24th year leading global slash international programs at a public research institution.
From New York to the Great Plains to Appalachia and ultimately to other parts of the world, you've been able to draw on the threads of a lot of experience. And you were also the lead of a mapping of the Abrahamic faith-based environmental activities in the Middle East and the North Africa region. I'm just describing that. What I'd like to ask is, if the Abrahamic traditions can teach us about our internal moral geography, about what we learn of the places we visit, as you just described, let's say, in the Great Plains, don't these religions tell us that the richness of life is at home in discovery rather than normalcy or getting to a new normal after crisis? Now, you mentioned this to me earlier in the week in terms of a return to the new normal. What do you mean by this? And what's at stake if we don't return to the new normal?
Well, what I find remarkable about this pandemic, a lot of things I find remarkable, but one of the things I find about it is that it's attacking the global system. I live in West Hartford, suburban Connecticut, nice home, nice community, part of the global privilege, 3 cars, and they just sit in the driveway. And I just stare at these cars, and I haven't gotten gas in a month. And I think about all the carbon that's stored in those cars that's not being released into the atmosphere. This virus has forced us all to just stop. It's like this great sacred pause where we have, the old normal, the normal 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago was you get up, you're in a hurry, you have a cup of coffee, you get in your car, you get in a traffic jam, you talk on the phone, you listen to the radio, you get to work, you have meetings all day, you get back in the car, you're in a traffic jam. Some people are traveling all the time. They're in restaurants, they're in hotels, they're all over the world. They're just moving around. And then people don't sleep enough, and I can go on and on and on. So everything stops. And the other thing that's also interesting to me is that if you look at the meatpacking plants, you understand that one of the reasons it's hitting meatpacking plants is because you have a lot of high density in there and people are having to work in this so-called essential industry. But if you look at meat and industrial meat, it's one of the causes of these pre-existing conditions. Right? Why is the United States so vulnerable to COVID-19? It's not just because we don't have a very high functioning health system, it's because we have very high levels of pre-existing conditions because people eat bad food. If you just look at what people eat, it's a disaster. And so this virus is going after all of our vulnerabilities. I'm hopeful that there'll be a great reset. And I'm hopeful that we'll look back in 10 years and say 2019 was the peak of carbon dioxide emissions in the history of humankind. And it's peak. I think I read the other day, it was 5.5% decline in carbon right now. Never would have happened without this crisis. I'm hopeful that families like myself and others will think, well, wait a minute, we really need 3 cars. I'm hopeful that the whole way we work will change. It's already happening. But why does everybody from Brooklyn have to get on a subway and go to these big towers in Manhattan to work? Maybe it's more efficient to have flexible hours, work at home. And these are things that are already starting to happen. But the most important reset is really the issue of inequality and structural racism. Mm-hmm. For some of us, the fact that people of color are being impacted more by COVID-19 is not a surprise. It's a sad reality of what I would call the geography of inequality. And I have the luxury to stay at home and work, but a lot of people don't, and they tend to be people in cities, and they They're overrepresented of people of color. The other piece of this, in terms of the Great Reset, is you know, how else can we reduce our carbon footprint? When I used to teach agricultural geography, I would talk about food that was jet lagged. Because one of the things that really is amazing, for those of you who've traveled, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You can get on a plane, you go somewhere, and if you go somewhere where they eat local food, it tastes completely different. So this need to rearrange the food system, to eat more local food, to eat food that is less carbon intensive, to eat food that is healthier, to eat less food, is essential. Because the industrialized food system, which is what the United States is built on, is broken. It's just flat out broken. And COVID-19 just exposed it. One more thing I'll say about the Great Reset, circling back to, you know, what you asked about sacred places and sacred spaces, is that wouldn't it be lovely if this was the Great Reset spiritually? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a surprise that yoga studios and Pilates and meditation is popping up all over the place. It's because people are stressed. People need to stop. Wouldn't it be great if we could reset by having better work-life balance, by having the people who are underemployed have more work and the people who have too much work have less work? So I know it's all very idealistic, but it's crises that create change. And my feeling is that if in 5 years we have the same level of ecosystem destruction, carbon emissions, traffic jams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then we will have missed the greatest opportunity in a generation to reset.
I want to stay with this phrase, geography of inequality, for a moment. It assumes, I think, that there's a web of pathologies that need to be addressed and deconstructed around inequality, whether that be racial inequality, how we understand high carbon intensivity without really looking closely at it, how we understand the relationship between immigration practices and the meatpacking industry, for instance. We are participating, perhaps, in some form of structural cruelty that is really ailing society, ailing the people around us, the well-being of others, creates a kind of spiritual anemia, we might call it that. What's your confidence that this society and that global society, if I could just think about that monolithically for the moment, would be able to really untangle this web of pathologies?
Yeah, that's a big question. And it is a question that is, we'll find out.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that this crisis has clearly demonstrated is that you need government.
Okay.
You need good government. If you actually look at the data, the global data, COVID-19, authoritarian governments and governments like ours that are just not organized for something like this, we're doing the worst. I mean, who's doing the best? Taiwan, South Korea, Germany, Israel, countries that all have nationalized healthcares, countries that all have highly functioning public sectors. And I think what happened in this country is that our focus was on the private accumulation of capital, and that's where money flowed for the last 40 years. We've generated a lot of wealth. If you look at the companies that are now just mainstream, you know, the Googles and the Microsofts and the Apples, you can go on and on. These are all part of the American, you know, exceptionalism, the American innovation ecosystem. It's been unbelievable. But at the same time, the public sectors, whether the federal government, state government, local government, municipalities, has struggled. Countries that have more funding public sectors and have a better balance between the private and the public sectors have done better during this pandemic. And we've been exposed because we don't have the infrastructure to do it. So I think the first thing that's critical here, you know, you have Bernie Sanders talking about socialism. I'm not going to ask what he is or what he's not, but his platform is not a socialist platform. Mm-hmm. His platform was for capitalist production, but with guardrails, mm-hmm. and for socialist consumption, where healthcare and education were a human right. That's not a radical Soviet style, you know, formulation. That's a very logical formulation that's been the core of social democracy in Europe and a lot of the democratic countries of East Asia. And it's been very, very successful. But we don't even know how to talk about it here. That's a problem. And that worries me. I mean, think of the Israeli innovation ecosystem, which is so dynamic. Well, all these startups don't have to worry about paying the healthcare costs for their workers, right? Yeah. We do. So that's the first place you have to start, is with the role of the public sector. I think the second place you need to start is just how we view nature. And this is where the Abrahamic traditions becomes really interesting, because, you know, they're contradictory, because, you know, God created the earth and the heavens. So in some senses, they take humans out of nature. And then there's, of course, so much written about the fact that we need to be good stewards of the earth. So on the one hand, we're separated from nature. On the other hand, we need to take care of nature. So we should really focus on the second piece, not just that we need to take care of nature, but we are part of nature. And that's why I think the COVID-19 message is, you know, you see birds singing differently now. You see animals coming into cities. I was watching a bear in my backyard yesterday. It was a beautiful black bear. That is a piece, which is how do we think about nature? How do we think about food? How do we think about soil? How do we think about air? You know, I used to tell my students, you know, don't worry about the earth. The earth will be fine. And they look at me like, what's wrong with me? And I'm like, well, it's humans you should be worried about. You know, humans might not make it, but the earth will be fine. The earth will spit us out and try something else.
Yeah. You know, as we're talking, I'm mindful of the kinds of conversations I've been having with others, and it gets to this theme. And I think what's often unspoken, but you're speaking to it now, I think, is that people feel a certain level of lamentation or lament because they're experiencing nature differently during COVID-19. The air is clear. You hear more birds. There's a coyote in our backyard recently as well. And they realize that they're missing something. What they're missing is something deeply inside, you know, a connection to one another, to the natural world around them, to the soil in their backyard where they might put up a row of corn. There seems to be some sort of very elemental, basic connection that we've overlooked in our race to overconsume the world. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm glad you brought up overconsumption, because that's critical. And, you know, our form of development is a form of development which is completely dependent on fairly intensive and excessive exploitation of Earth's resources. Spiritually, oh, how many people, if they're having a bad day or having a bad week, will get in their car and go to the mall? Mm-hmm. Now it's you go to Amazon or wherever you shop online. Mm-hmm. So I do think that consumption is a core problem. When I was a freshman in 1974 in Worcester, Massachusetts, at Clark University, which had a very, very PhD program in psychology. I was a geography major. I was having some adjustment issues. I was living in New York City with my parents. I came up to Worcester, and it was just, you know, it's the freshman year. Everybody has some adjustment problems. And there was a graduate student who I became close with, because I'd sit in his little apartment, you know, the RA in the dorm, and we'd talk, and he'd help me. And one day in the middle of the semester, he knocks on my door. He says, I need to talk to you. I go into his apartment. He says, I'm leaving the university. I said, why? He says, I got a job. I said, do what? He said, subliminal advertising. I said, I have no idea what that means. He said, well, what I do is you put sexual images into video so your unconscious sees it, but your conscious doesn't know it's seeing it. It makes you want to consume that product. And I was just completely stunned. And I said, wait a minute, you're getting a PhD in psychology, and you're going to go get a job that try to get people to consume more through unconscious sexual images? And I've thought about that moment, because this is 1974. Mm-hmm. An entire generation in this country has grown up with that, where it's not even just that piece of it. It's the food system. They put things in food that make you want to have it. Mm-hmm. So the system is built on consumption, and that's a problem, because obviously if you're going to have a better relationship with nature, if you're going to reverse climate change, and as you've pointed out, if you're going to really reconnect with the natural world and reconnect with yourself spiritually and your neighbors and your friends and your colleagues and the people you might not even like, mm-hmm. It has to be with a significant reduction in consumption. And that's the other part of this crisis that's fascinating me. You know, I have, I don't know, 10 suits. I don't know how many pairs of shoes, you know, ties. I wear 3 pairs of clothes now. It reminds you of my grandfather in the Bronx. You know, he always dressed nice. But it was, he had two pairs of shoes, two jackets, two pairs of pants, a tie, and three shirts. And he always wore them. He looked fantastic. Uh-huh. That was it. I don't need this stuff. So I'm hoping that this reset will really be a reset on consumption. I know a lot of young people. I mean, I've got six kids in various capacities, and they get it. They completely get it. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful because the young generation understands that just can't consume for all kinds of reasons. It doesn't work.
You have been listening to Religica. In cooperation with the United Nations Environment Program, Faith for Earth Initiative, and the STM Center for Religious Wisdom and World Affairs at Seattle University.